Maintenant, nous allons accueillir Saibel Norda, qui a des responsabilités importantes et successives aux Pays-Bas, notamment préside l'Academic Corporation Association et aussi l'Institut Magna Charta, et qui nous montrera comment essayer d'atteindre les objectifs de l'Open Access. Et je crois que c'est un militant chevronné de cette cause qui va certainement nous éclairer fortement sur les conduites à tenir.
Je vous demande de me pardonner que je ne parle pas français cet après-midi. C'est simplement parce que je ne connais pas l'argot français sur Open Access. Je suis désolé. I have added some of my present occupations to this first slide because they have a bearing on my view of the topic. I'm president of the Academic Cooperation Association, which is a bundling of European agencies on cross-border education. And one of the many ways in which open access is benefiting the larger public is by enabling cross-border education. Imagine you prepare a MOOC. You are lecturing to the whole world, yet every reference you make is to stuff that is only available to those who are working in a university, that is, having a well-connected and well-supplied university library. So open access also has a very important role to play in cross-border education. In addition to that, I'm president of the Magna Carta Observatory in Bologna, which is a worldwide organization bundling some 800 universities worldwide on the basic values of higher education. Basic values of independence, of academic freedom, of integrity, of open enrollment and fair access to higher education. And open access, in a certain sense of the word, is also about fair access, a public role that is the role universities should play in societies. And more precisely, I have been invited to advise the Dutch government on open access last year because the present minister felt that it is about time to change the rules of the game. And maybe it plays a role that some of the major players in the field have a Dutch ancestry. And as a matter of fact, the whole change from publishing from a friendly industry to an independent industry, having a business relation to the scientific world, took place in my country, in the Netherlands. My talk on open access this afternoon is not the first time I talk on open access. Next year, I'll celebrate the 20th anniversary. My first talk on open access in an international meeting was in 1996. And I must confess that in those 20 years, we have been talking an awful lot on open access and have made some progress in realizing those ideals, but by far not to the extent that we dreamt of 20 years ago. So it is about time to try to change the rules of the game. By way of introduction, earlier this year, I was interviewed by a Danish journalist, and he put me 6 questions. And I have repeated them here on these first 3 slides. Why has open access to scholarly publications become such an issue? Well, the answer is, in a way, very simple. Because since the introduction of digital formats, publishers felt they had to protect their products by restricting license. In the 19th century, we have invented public libraries. And since the 19th century, buying a book and making it available to the wider public was the method of realizing open access. And there was nothing a publisher could do about it, because after you had bought the book or the journal, you were free to do with it whatever you would like to. So open access as an issue is a direct paradoxical consequence of the introduction of digital formats. The digital revolution in publishing promises much more freedom and a wider coverage. Yet at the same time, it made publishers anxious to protect their rights and their products, because from now on, their product was no longer a physical one that one could acquire and lend out to one's friends and neighbors or to the public at large, but it was something that could be used, imitated, copied, and distributed and redistributed at the cost of the publishers. So it was a response of publishers to this very positive digital revolution. Why is open access an issue, the journalist went on asking, of public interest? Basically, for the same reasons public libraries were invented back in the 19th century. Because we wanted users of scientific results not to be dependent on their friendly relations to the bishop, the duke, the king, or very well-established scientists. We wanted the general public, we wanted students, we wanted teachers to be independent in their search for sources and to have independent and free access to these sources. And this is just as true and just as important and basic today. A couple of years ago, a survey was being made in the United Kingdom showing that all medical doctors working outside academic centers, in cities and villages, in hospitals, in private practices, as a general practitioner, all those medical doctors outside the academic medical centers didn't have access to 70% of medical publications. So 70% of medical publications were not available to the majority of medical doctors in that country. And I bet this is true in France, in Germany, in Italy, in Spain, just as well. So when we talk about the issue of public interest, we're not talking only about a theory. We're talking about a practice that is really leaving people out of a very important part of important sources, important to their scientific work, to their professional work. Third question was, why is it taken so long to find a way out? Well, we have had some of those elements already in the discussion just the last 10 minutes. Most publishers find the introductions of new business models based on broadcasting rather than subscription, risky. So they stick to traditional ways as long as they can. When I talk to people in leading positions in the international publishing business privately, almost all of them accept that in 5, 6, 7 years from now, the situation will be a situation of open access. Yet, they fear to make the necessary steps into that direction. So they know this is a transition that one day will have taken place. But they can't make themselves make that change. And then the journalist went on asking, is the transition indeed difficult or risky? Well, I compare it to another 19th century innovation, the transition from sail to steam in shipping. Throughout most of the 19th century, the British Navy refused to have only steamships because they did not want to be dependent on coal. You needed a harbor where you could have your coal to be able to carry on. And the fact that they had been needing wind for centuries didn't make up any of that fear. So it took decades of transition to change the shipping industry from sail to steam. And the interesting lesson for the publishing industry is that very few shipping companies survived that change. So it was new companies that were steamship companies, and it was the former ones that went under, that didn't survive. So it is a true matter of risk-taking business innovation that requires a business mind much more than a banker's mind, only driven by financial interests and keeping your financial interest by using the and continuing the present model as long as you can. Is it only a problem of publishers? The journalist said. I see relatively few academics work for open access. Of course, we have many meetings, and we have many friends because many of people going to these meetings are the same people. It is a community that is strong, that is large, yet it's only a small percentage of academia worldwide. Why is this? I'm convinced that it is mostly because academics do not realize that easy digital access that they are enjoying is confined to academia. When I speak to my colleagues who leave the university at pension age, they suddenly get a keen interest in the library card. They suddenly have a keen interest in their email addresses at the university and their access code. They have never realized throughout their career that they had this free access that the university, the library paid for. And suddenly, when they are out on their own, sitting in their apartment with their own books, willing to have access to the library they once were able to use on a day-to-day basis, they realize there is someone paying. There is some very important link that is enabling them to have that beautiful paradise world of easy access. So it is very, very, very important that all of us realize that every school teacher, whether it's in primary education or in secondary education, in professional schools or whatever, has no access whatsoever to the majority of the kind of material that we, working in a university that is well established and well furnished, have. Most people with an academic profession working outside academia are living without those access possibilities and outside that kind of a paradise. At the same time, many of us only very recently have discovered the great individual interest for all of us to be published in a digitally open manner, to be searchable, to be findable everywhere. It's completely clear that if your stuff is accessible everywhere, not just as a title, not just as a summary, but a full article in open access, you will not only be quoted much more and used much more, but you will play a much more important role in the scientific debate and in scientific usage worldwide. So open access is a matter of public interest, of professionals and the larger public outside academia, but it's also in the individual interest of academic authors. Well, the last question this journalist asked me, how can change be stimulated and brought about, or will we just be muddling on? Well, the not so easy, but yet true answer is that it can only be done by international cooperation in academia, among science funders, and between governments. Exactly because scholarly publishing, to a large extent, is an international market dominated by a couple of internationally dominant multinational players that cannot and will not migrate only on a national scale. So there is this uneven, unbalanced situation where academia, very much fragmented into a multitude of disciplines, science funders, fragmented by nations and also by disciplines, and governments with their own national picture of all of this, this fragmented world must cooperate to be able to join forces and counterbalance, to be able to withstand the monopolistic pressures and policies of multinational publishers. We have been talking about this for many, many years, and we have the support of the European Commission. This is a presentation that José was presenting in a meeting where both of us were taking part 2 years ago. And part of the sentences were the same he used just a minute ago, because the objectives of the European Union have been clear and supportive of open access over the years. No doubt about that. And the willingness to promote optimization of the impact of publicly funded scientific research is completely clear. And the expected impacts were listed then, they were listed before, and they are listed now. And the solution to all of that, clearly stated in that presentation and in later and in earlier presentations on the part of the Commission, is open access to scientific information. Yet, the question that is really making all the difference is the question to be posed afterwards. How do we get there? A policy and a statement is not enough. I'll get to that in a minute. 2 years ago, 3 years ago, a colleague of ours, Alma Swan, a professional working in this field, for many programs and agencies supporting open access, gave a presentation at another Brussels conference on open access. And she said, we have a couple of bottlenecks to face. It is on our part, on the part of academia, a lack of awareness and understanding of the real nature of the challenges that we are facing. We see a very fragmented and in some countries limited policy development, thinking that the present situation is not too bad or will improve just by itself. We have a couple of legal copyright related issues. There is a strong undercurrent of misconceptions about quality, as if open access journals and open access publishings would by nature have lower quality. And there is, of course, the issue of the cost of publishing in open access journals, caused by the fact that many of the international publishers, until very recently, were asking to be paid twice for subscriptions and for open access publishing, by asking APCs of considerable quantity. So quite a few bottlenecks, and it's almost a euphemism if you list it in such a quiet way. So she said, what do we do? What do we have to do? And she listed this familiar list of things that we have been doing over the last 15 years. We have been building infrastructure. We have been setting up a network of repositories. We have made these repositories interlinked and talking to each other. We have seen good policy development at some institutions, in some countries, and in many international meetings. We have seen many efforts for good and well-meaning advocacy and culture change. And we have efforts of collaboration, networking, and coordination. Yet with all of that, we still must conclude that international cooperation in academia, among science funders, between governments, is easier said than done. And this is basically because of the nature of our business, of our side of the business. The fragmentation along a multitude of lines, fragmentation between disciplines, between types of institutions, between various classes of academics and professionals, between nations, between funders and university leaders, between academics and students, between outside academics, and so on and so on. And this fragmentation causes a fundamental weakness and inability to exercise policies of pressure. And pressure is all we need to change the pace of transition. If we are not ready to strike, if we are not ready to discontinue subscriptions or deals with big publishers, no way the majority of them will move. I've been the president of the Dutch Research University Group for 7 years, until 3 years ago. I have never, ever been successful in convincing my colleagues that we must be ready for that kind of an attitude. And only recently, last year, my successor did convince his colleagues that we must be willing to take that final step. So the present negotiations that are going on between the Dutch universities, the Dutch research universities, and Elsevier Reed, are negotiations that are carried on with a cloud of a threat of strike above it. For the first time, Dutch universities have made it very clear that if we don't get a fair deal, meaning no extra charge for open access publishing, no APCs, APCs be part of the big deal, not at extra cost, but at the same cost, subscription has already been high enough over the years. If that is not going to be the result of the deal, from January 1st, 2016 on, Dutch universities won't be continuing their subscription deal with Elsevier. And universities are very much aware that this is a risky attitude and will not be easily sold to academics from that day onwards. So what are they doing right now is already talking to academics at very many places to prepare them for that kind of consequences. And to be understood well, this is not a way these colleagues are taking to really harm the interests of academics. This is because they realize that if you are not willing to exercise a policy of pressure, you're not going to get anywhere. And if you compare the situation in the world of academia to each and every multinational publisher, you see there a unity of purpose and action, at least outside, that is to be envied by all of us. So what we need is concerted action. What we need is an intensification of what has been done so far. An orchestrated effort, well synchronized, running parallel in a number of countries, including serious, meaning balanced negotiations with key publishers. If we are embarking upon such negotiations, by the way, it is very important that on the part of academia, we also show unity of purpose and action. If we don't, then the old Latin motto will be valid also here, divide ac impera. The division will be leaving the command to your opponent. And to be successful in any negotiations, as I said, it's important to be willing to really go far enough to put real pressure, but one should also think of the other side. To be successful in any negotiation, there are two factors that are absolutely crucial. It is pressure, yes. It is pressure to make the other side accept the need to change, but it is also a degree of comfort. Offering a degree of comfort to the other side to enable them to accept the outcome. And it is this strategy that is the kind of strategy that probably has a fair chance of being successful. Change may be in the air, but it's in the air already for 20 years. It won't come by itself to its conclusion. So in the interest of making progress, we must add on to the wide array of analyses, of policies and statements, and we must start a wider set of parallel actions, roadmap negotiations. And I realize very well this cannot be done on a global scale. These last couple of years, I've been attending many internationally global conferences of academia in several continents and off several continents. And it is a no-go to think that within 1 or 2 years we have a kind of concerted action agreement between continents in a worldwide matter. Already between North America and Europe, it will not be easy to reach that kind of an agreement in just a couple of years. So it is very important to make a realistic start. And when preparing this kind of thinking in the Netherlands, and after we had ensured the strong political support of the relevant Dutch minister, we have been preparing a plan for 2016, when the Dutch government is president of the EU for half a year. And what we try to do is to build up a coalition of a good number of member states of the EU, represented by their governments, their academic institutions, and by key funders, a group of which every member is ready to engage in such an intensified effort, of concerted action to build some sort of a Schengen area in Europe of maybe 7, maybe 12, maybe 15 countries that by January 1st, 2020, will have realized open access to scholarly publications in those countries on a fair basis. So not trying to reform the whole worldwide system, because as long as Elsevier is making the kind of money that we are just shown by selling many more subscriptions to the Chinese and by doubling their market share in Africa and in Latin America, and by having a dumping pricing policy elsewhere. And this is not just Reed Elsevier, their colleagues are doing similar things, like all international multinationals. As long as that is the case, it is not feasible to have that kind of an agreement at a world scale. You can only try to get that on a scale that is that you can handle, and such a European grouping first talks with the other side show may be doable. Just today, Kurt Ketelaere, the Secretary General of LERU, the European group of some 25, 30 research universities, issued the LERU statement for the 2016 Dutch EU presidency on open access. The link is here. You can also find it on Twitter if you use one of these identifiers, Kurt Ketelaere or LERU News. And it's interesting that the Secretary General Kurt Ketelaere has given this statement that he asked you to sign and support in support of the action I just described in a very brief manner, with the payoff, Christmas is over. It is January now. We have to go back to work. We have to go back to fair relations, to a balanced policy. At the beginning, I said that next year I celebrate my 20th anniversary as a speaker on open access at international conferences. I hope 2016 will be the last year I speak on these issues at international conferences, not because of my health, but because of the health of the issue. I hope that from 16 onwards, we will see a real progress to open access by a combination of methods, by ensuring a minimal embargo on repository licensing, by ensuring no extra payments on golden open access, and by making golden access not just a favorite topic of people like myself who talk on this all the time, but of every single academic, both in academia and outside. And I hope you will be joining us in this effort. Thank you very much.
Merci Seibel pour ce défi que vous nous lancez à tous et que je pense qu'on souhaite vivement rejoindre la politique que tracera le gouvernement néerlandais au sein de l'Union. S'il y a quelques questions.
Thank you very much for your very nice talk, which giving some hope of action after some, I'm probably, you were like me, quite depressed by some of previous talk, because the fact of life where we are in really bad situation, but you give us a chance. And having this, you're right, this presidency of Dutch land, it's great. Okay, about action. There may be several things. You, as you mentioned very nicely, the Dutch have proposed that editors who are working for some editorial boards of Elsevier, but that could be more general. It can be to many other of those publishers which are exploiting too much the system. the idea, though they propose that people resign. I think it's much stronger if people just get on strike. Because if you resign from an editorial board, you just leave the seat and someone else is very, very pleased to take the seat. You see, though it doesn't change the system from, I mean, at the core. Though I suggest that many people in editorial board just decide, okay, we stop. And there is an issue there. I'm exactly in this situation since now more than 3 years. And there is an issue there. Because when you're a member of an editorial board, a very weak point is that we don't have any contract. We are without any legal context. And like that, of course, they ask me to resign. And I say, no, show me the contract. So give me the rule of the game. And though if we, from internal to the editorial board, we ask to have a clear legal situation, because we work for free, but we exist. And in fact, the way publishers treat us, it's just the way we don't exist. We are just cash cow. And if the cash cow is not nice, we just pick another cash cow and the system go on. I think the people who are already in situation of being member of editorial board, they should, from inside, try to change things. Of course, it's very difficult. I mean, I don't detail here. So that's the first point. A second point, for me, as important as that, the weakness we, the scientists, have is that we don't know, as you mentioned beautifully, we are not aware of the system. And very naively, we signed the copyright transfer form without even reading it because we want our paper to be published as soon as possible. We should, and here we need the help of the public and, I mean, at some more governmental level, we should make sure that we never give our copyright in an exclusive fashion. As simple as that. When you give your copyright for free, which is the case, it should be given non-exclusive. And if you just keep that, you change the system. And in fact, this is in fact more in the spirit of what we have in French, which is author right, which is different from copyright. Because in author right, I cannot give my copyright away without being compensated by some money, and it has to be made as a contract. When I signed the copyright agreement, it's not a contract, it's just a piece of paper. And even worse than that, only one of the co-authors signed this piece of paper, and that gives the copyright away for 70 years. I mean, that gives the copyright to the publisher, the intellectual ownership, for 70 years after the death of the last co-author to die. Though we have to break this system. This system is complete nonsense. Okay, these are kind of two directions where we think we should put some pressure. And as you mentioned very well, it has to be made at international level and with the help of government and institution and also some good legal advisor.
Yes, well, thank you very much. I mean, you have much more experience with strikes in France than we have in the Netherlands. So I take your advice on that, that is a better method than by walking out. The second question is also a very important one. I mean, this whole thing of signing your copyright waiver once you have, or you, when you want your piece to be published by whatever publisher, is something that most of us are unable to do individually. Because we are all part of a, in a way, a sworn and silent community that accepts it. So we have to make this a public matter. Because one of the very nice and also tricky sides of scholarly publishing is that it is playing into our reputation game. We all want to be read and admired, if not by our colleagues, by our students, and by the anonymous community of readers worldwide. So we want to be present and we want to be visible at the best possible platforms. And we are ready to do almost everything, apart from maybe selling our souls, to get there. So to one of the first meetings I spoke on this topic was an international global meeting we organized in the Netherlands in 1999 on copyright issues, and we made a model copyright declaration that would exclude this. This is 16 years ago, and that model agreement has never been used anywhere. There were Australians there, Canadians, Americans, Europeans from everywhere, and all of us said, yes, let's do this. Yet the force of the present system, where it's so attractive and where it's so tempting to just sign, or not even sign, just accept the declaration, is so strong. And so we will have to work hard to convince our colleagues that this is the road ahead.
Yes, I was very impressed by the initiative taken by the Dutch universities and scientists concerning the threat of boycott. And I discussed that with your colleague from the University of Nijmegen, who is in charge of this negotiation. And I think one of my questions was, you partly perhaps answered with Illyrio, that was my question. I haven't read this declaration yet. Have you tested this idea with colleagues from the Illyrio universities, to see whether in their respective universities or respective countries, people would be prepared for such an action, which in a way could be an indicator of how ready the scientific community is to really take actions. And then other issues should be handled, I think, at the European level, copyright issues, etc. That's something, as you say, no individual, no university alone can handle efficiently. So what is the thermometer at the moment among the research universities as the first circle to which these ideas could be tested and evaluated?
Well, the statement, the Liru statement, is not talking about boycotts and strikes. It is talking in decent and civil language about the goals and purposes. But at the same time, it is a very important sign of support to this whole plan. Exactly, because Liru, after it had been very firm in open access 5 or 6 years ago, it started to become more silent in latter years. So some of us were fearing that the interests of Oxford University Press and Cambridge University Press, Oxford and Cambridge being among the most prominent members of Liru, was sort of dimming the sharp sides, the sharp edges of the issue. So I was very pleased when I understood some weeks ago from Koert de Ketelaere that they were preparing this kind of a statement. So it shows that in the main issue that I have been presenting to you, and I have kept it as simple as I could, and I think we have to keep it as simple as we can, because the devil may be in the details, but you can win this game only when you stay at the headlines, is in having this kind of powerful support. And so we will sure use this statement to our benefit. Yet at the same time, we will have to, and I hope my former Dutch colleagues will really stay by their word and be, if must, be willing to do this kind of a boycott, because that will be the kind of sign that may get this whole thing into motion. If you threaten to strike or to boycott, it's just your word, unless you are forced to do it, and then it becomes a very powerful weapon in your hand. So I have this paradoxical feeling. I hope they reach an agreement which is a fair agreement, but silently I also think it wouldn't be bad if they were forced to do this boycott thing, because that would create an extra emphasis in this whole, which is in fact a power battle. And we have just been demonstrated what kind of financial issues are at stake on the other side. Well, I forgot to mention one issue in my talk that might be good to add at this stage. Sometimes colleagues tell me, why do you bother? Why can't we just leave this whole bunch of multinational publishers out of the game and start all over again? Well, I mean, if I had the tiniest expectation that the international science community would be able to organize itself in such a manner as to guarantee peer-reviewed scholarly publishing in the decades to come, I would be joining them. But I do not see the possibility at all. Maybe in some small, very unified fields of science, you can do this. But in most subjects, I expect us as world academic community to be completely unable to organize scholarly publishing in a manner that is comparable to what multinational publishers are able to do. Organizing new titles, organizing editorial boards, setting up this whole process of peer review, and so on and so on. It is a kind of task not to be underestimated. And it's something that we need to continue our system of scholarly publishing as a system of trust, as a system that is reliable, and as a system that is fair in terms of access and treatment to all of us who want to be published there.
Alors, une dernière question avec une réponse rapide et après la pause.
So, Mr. Nuda, your list of bottlenecks to open access leads me to ask you a question, if I may, please. And I know there's a whole session dedicated to that tomorrow, so perhaps question and answer will be brief. But to me, it seems that one of the major bottlenecks to open access is the gift that academia has bestowed onto publishing when with the mantra, publish or perish. And that the research assessment exercise is a key part as to why academia continues to use Elsevier. And that as long as this is done the way it is done today, Elsevier has a strong barrier to entry here. So can you comment as to whether you share that view and perhaps any sign that this may be changing?
Well, there again is a mixed picture. When I visit universities in Romania, colleagues tell me that they get 200 euros or 300 euros per article that is published in a peer-reviewed journal in the Thomson Index. And if you are a professor at NARC University and you make 700 or 1,000 euro a month, this extra bonus of 200 or 300 euro is substantial money. So this is a method of stimulating research output that is promoting productivity. The other side of the picture, first in the United Kingdom and since last year also in the Netherlands, we have stopped asking productivity from researchers. In the research assessment exercise in the United Kingdom, the only question is, show us the best 3 or 4 articles you published last 7 years. In the Netherlands, we have now embraced the same system. So it's no longer a matter of volume, it's a matter of quality. And rather show 3 or 4 good articles over 5 or 7 years than a list of 20. Well, if that is the approach, if numbers and volume no longer counts, but when it becomes a matter of content and quality, a lot of this sort of increase in numbers is taken out of the system. So one of my advices, I work a lot in Germany, one of my advices to my German colleagues is do away with this kind of productivity game. Apart from the fact that in terms of productivity, one should also look at the figure of usage. Usually, the average article that is scientifically published worldwide gets 1.7 readers. So and readers is a rough term. Readers is, it's more than a hit, but it's something in between real reading and hitting on the topic. So we should not betray and just not tell ourselves that every article that we publish, all of those 25 we have published in 5 years, will find the readership they want to and you want to have for them. So better concentrate and have 3 or 4 or 5. Maybe we should have a plan to really reduce the number of articles that we publish instead of have an explosion of articles. So this is another matter to discuss at home, in your schools, in places like this, with your colleagues. Why can't we collectively change the rules of the game? So part of the rules of the game are in the hands of the publishers, but we have still quite some of those rules in our own hands. And we are only too often very easily sort of taken prison by the present rules instead of stimulated to escape from prison and do it in a different manner.
Thank you.